be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hello, this is the Richie Wexler of Vintage Analyst Archive Outsider Podcast. This is a bonus episode of two different shorter interviews I did. We have kind of a focus. I do a focus on different Instagram accounts I really like. And I'm putting these two together because they kind of fit really well. The first one is called An Earful of Wax. It's an period, earful period of period wax. It's by my friend Joe Buck Roberts. I met Joe years and years ago in Baltimore at this like archival screening. He's a big, you know, film buff and just knows about a lot of things, but particularly he's a lifelong fan of music. He's a musician. And he runs a page just kind of posting about different music. He plays a little bit. He gives a little story, a little history. It's a really great page. And it's getting more into like country, gospel, some outsider stuff. Joe joined me in the episode we did with Mojo Nixon as a co-host. And also the one, and one of the ones we did with Joe from Found Footage Festival as co-host. So you might know Joe at this point. And then we have another episode, Dollar Country, very similar world, run by Frank and Fantini. Frank reached out to me to offer me some advice on posting, and we got a little friendly, and I just like this page. He's been doing this podcast for years. He has this huge archive. And they're both kind of in the same world to a certain extent, some outsider, a lot of rare country, and they kind of know their stuff. They know about the people, they know about the area, they know all about the music, the musician. So please check out both their, I'll link all the information, I'll link their Instagrams, I'll link, there's an article about Franklin, I'll link information about these guys, and I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much, until another time. Thank you. Joe,
still there?
You got about 20 minutes?
Yeah, I got 20 minutes.
Give me the name of your page because I'm spacey. I couldn't find you today because I forgot the name of your page.
An Earful of Wax. There's a period between each word. An period, earful, period of, period, wax.
Where are you at? Where do you live these days?
I'm in Columbia, South Carolina.
How long have you been there?
I moved here in 2004, so 18, 19 years.
Where are you
like
from, by the way? Are you from that area?
I'm originally from a little town called Chester, which is about an hour's drive north of here. It's just kind of a little small, nothing kind of town, just a wasteland almost.
So I met Joe Buck years ago at this ephemeral film fest, and we've just kind of talked and realized we were both kind of birds out of water? What's the fish out of water?
Yeah, fish out of water.
sorry, my brain is too much research. And I don't know. We kept in touch for a bunch of years, and I really am a big fan of what you know he's doing. I feel like, you know, sometimes I just want to specialize in one thing, and I feel like if I did, it would be like your page. I want to get a little bit into the record stuff, but I also just want to kind of talk to you as a collector.
Yeah.
And before we get to, you know, were there other things you've collected either in conjunction with music or before music that you want to talk about?
Music is the biggest collection. Like I certainly have my little library of books and films and stuff like that. And a lot of it is kind of the same sort of era. It's the middle to late 20th century and sort of the less mainstream stuff. I mean, there's certainly mainstream things, but I'm into a lot of love for when people take the art into their own hands.
Okay.
So that's a thing that I really gravitate toward, whether it's in films or in books or certainly in music as well.
Can you expound on that? What do you mean by take the art into their own hands?
Before the internet sort of came in, there was only so many channels that you had that you could go through, very official, you know. So there were independent record labels, yes, but there were, the big dream was to get on some big label. But I think that when people sort of decide to create for themselves, or they have this deep burning desire to communicate with you toward music, they're not going to let something like, I can't get a film deal stand in the way, or I can't get a record deal. So, you know, whether it's somebody who goes into a local studio and creates a record and private presses it, or whatever the case may be, I think that that sincerity and that that drive that is unencumbered by some sort of corporate goal, you know, yeah. The goal for folks like that isn't to sell a gold record. It's to put out something that means something to them and have you hear it.
So would you, does that fit into the, even if it's, I mean, I know you post more country gospel stuff, but does that kind of fall into private press as the way it's done?
I have a lot of love for the private press, for a lot of the private press albums. I mean, there's a lot of garbage out there too. But as far as that goes, I think that there's the private press, but you also had this era where, and I think Zappa said something along these lines, where like the people who were heading these record companies and these film companies, they didn't really understand what people wanted because of the big cultural shifts that were happening in the 60s, certainly. And so there was a lot more willingness to put things out there just to see what would stick.
Right. Yeah. He's amazing in terms of how we talked and thought about music.
Oh yeah.
I guess my connection in thinking about it, I think about private press as like folk music, and I think that's a traditional definition of like music of the people. And what I'm hearing you say, and what is also my favorite kind of music is music that someone just made to make it without any intention of what was going to happen to it. You know, they may have had some dreams, but it was just that they had to make it. And it fits into like, I don't know if outsider is the best way to put it, but there's a purity. I think a lot about some of my favorite documentary photographers who shot for 30 fucking 40 years and then looked at what they had.
Yeah.
There's a purity to just doing it for its own sake. And I just feel like, you know, that gets lost when you, it obviously gets very lost with when you bring money into it.
I agree. I think that, you know, authenticity might not be totally the word, but I think that when you're creating for the act of creating, or you're creating because you just have to get this out of your system. I think that there is a certain, there's a beauty in it, even if it's not polished, even if it's not perfect. I would rather hear somebody who believes in what they're singing or believe the music that they're making than is trying to go for some brass ring, you know?
So I want to ask you like a series of three questions, and you could kind of do them in parts. Is I'm curious on what flavors of stuff you collect, how you find stuff, and then if any, how you archive.
Yeah. So musically, I love rock and roll. Rock and roll was sort of my ground base. Like I heard Johnny B. Goode by Chuck Berry when I was 4 years old.
And holy shit.
That lit the fuse on whatever.
Yeah.
My everything would be. So that's ground zero.
That makes perfect. That was a powerful time for music. That makes a lot of sense, but go on. Sorry.
No. And I like country music. I like jazz. I like blues. I don't like everything, but I keep my ears open to a lot of stuff, and just I'm looking for something that moves me, whether it engages me intellectually or whether it has just a hook that I can't get rid of, or if it speaks to me in some way. And things can speak to you in different ways, but I think that I'm looking for connection is what I'm looking for.
If I had to describe it as like preachers, are there certain albums or certain performers that are like your teachers or preachers?
In terms of influence, all the early rock and roll stuff, Johnny Cash was a big thing. I got into Johnny Cash when I was probably in second, third grade.
Holy shit.
That blew my mind because, again, the storytelling involved.
Yeah.
The music was very pared down, but there was something very didn't feel put on. When I got into Johnny Cash, I was probably like 7 or 8.
What do you think, what in you as a 7, 8-year-old could figure out that he was an authentic person, if anything? Why do you think you realized that his music was special and real and that it spoke to you?
Yeah, I think that first of all, the voice has a very commanding presence, but it's certainly something that you would hear today. It's rough around the edges. Even if he didn't write the song, I think that he had a way of sort of stories being told, and they were very direct. They conveyed an awful lot, but they weren't flowery. They weren't obtuse or anything like that. So it was, I could understand what he was actually talking about. And Shel Silverstein became a big influence. I came to Shel Silverstein through Johnny Cash. So I would always back a record and see songwriting credits. And I noticed that there were several by S. Silverstein.
Have you ever read his bio?
Was it a named Shell? Is that what
I think it's
called?
It's a boy named Shell, yeah.
I read it several years ago. I think that the person who wrote it did the best they could. He was a guarded man in a lot of ways. And I think that there was an amount of sort of having to dig that the author did. And certainly when you run into things with like families and stuff like that, you know, it limits what you're able to do. Given all the constraints that the author was probably under, I think they did a tremendous job. The thing that blew my mind, and I don't think I got this from the book, I think I got it through just collecting records, was he was like a chameleon. Did all kinds of articles and cartoons and stuff for Playboy. He could write for children. And musically, you know, he was kind of into the folk scene a little bit. And then, you know, he got with like the Dr. Hook and the Medicine.
Right.
Kind of thing, but he was also like knee deep in Nashville. Like he was in the 70s. If you did country music, you were probably going to cover a Shel Silverstein.
I don't think I realized he got so much in country. Did you ever see the movie he was in with Dustin Hoffman?
Yes. Who is Harry Keller?
Oh my God. I feel like that movie in my brain feels like an unearthed Coen Brothers movie.
It's incredible.
And he performs in that. He performs on stage with the band.
When I was, I don't know, probably 14 or 15, I had been looking for a copy of that movie for quite some time because I knew that Shel Silverstein was in it. And I just wanted to see that voice come out of that face. I couldn't imagine it, but I ended up coming across a copy of it on videotape when I was probably about 13 or so. And golly, to this day, that is a very near and dear to my heart, because it feels like a dream.
Did you ever hear about the book of ABZs?
Oh yeah, I have the ABZs. Yeah.
Oh, no, you have the one without the warning, or with the warning?
I have the one with the warning. Yeah, it was
okay.
Sometime in the 90s.
I fucking love. I love that story. And in the book, there was a story which I've never been able to pinpoint the book, but it was he had like made a deal, and they just kept wanting. I look at it. It's funny. I compare him a lot to Jim Henson because they're born a day apart. I only know this because I have my birthday on Jim's and Shell's the next day, and I feel like they both were like these subversive people, but they came off in other ways that people just thought they were like, you know, these peaceful like, oh, I make kids stuff, but they were both subversive as fuck.
Like for both of them, I think that there was a sincerity that shone through even when they were being subversive that allowed them to sort of navigate those worlds.
There was something in the book where he was like done with kids books and they were like, we want another one. And apparently I remember reading something where I don't know what the book is, but he's like, I want you to make this book that's about my penis. And that was the way that was the agreement he made. And it's not like called his penis, but yeah. The book apparently is just about his dick, and that was how he kind of got out of his contract or finalized his contract. Do you know what book that is?
I don't. I know that he did a recording session in the late 60s for Columbia called, and you might have heard it. It was a demo. It was called Fuck 'Em. It's all these songs, and I think that it might have been a contractual thing too.
Yeah.
That are they're not like filthy, but they're very, that late 60s, early 70s kind of sleazy fun. They're very sleazy and very funny.
And he was like, I mean, he lived in the mansion. He slept with thousands of women. Like he was the player, you know, he was in that world. Well, the problem, I like Shel Silverstein. I have a problem with Uncle Shelby.
Uncle Shelby's a dirty old man.
Uncle Shelby reads very, very much creepier than Shel does. And his creepy voice on some of those records is, and then, you know, if you look at that person, that persona, he's making a, you know, the ABZ book is written by Uncle Shelby, and he meets this guy to the Boy Scouts, which just has a lot of horrible implications when you know, in that context, but I love him for it.
And I think that, again, some of that came from the sort of satirical, there's a book that was released that collected a bunch of his travel writings for Playboy. He had this way of being able to navigate the seamier sides and the more sincere and heartfelt sides, and neither of them felt put on. It's impressive. None of it feels fake.
I want to ask you a question just because I feel like I consider Lee Hazelwood a little more of a private press version of Johnny Cash. I'm curious on your thoughts on Lee Hazelwood.
I actually found a Lee Hazelwood record at the Goodwill today. I found a copy.
Holy shit.
It was A Lonesome Town.
That's a fucking score.
Yeah. I think Lee Hazelwood's great. I think he's an incredible storyteller as well. And again, kind of like Shel, he was able to work in all these different worlds. He was able to work with like the Vegas-y kind of stuff. He was able to work with country musicians. He went to Sweden and just freaked out.
Right.
Did a breakup record called Requiem for an Almost Lady. It is piss and vinegar, but it's done in such a deceptively laid back kind of way.
13th is my one of my favorites, only because it's like this rare fucking country lounge album, which you don't get really often. I think it's something about it. I love this. I kind of love the like swing of it. I like lounge music and I love the swing of that. I'm curious on how much you do research into the people that make these records. Is that part of your process to learn about these people as much as it is to have the albums, or is it enough to just hear them and understand them?
I like to dig in if I can to sort of get an idea of the world that this came into. And a lot of the stuff that I write on my Instagram is sort of the end result of me just diving down the rabbit hole and sort of trying to contextualize the music, not just from the personal, be it my personal or the artist's personal, but sort of the world it came into.
Are there two or three characters that you've found by finding their albums and then kind of, you know, they were interesting to you as people?
Yeah. Going back to the world of country music, David Allan Coe is a very contentious figure, and I certainly understand. I think that his story is incredibly fascinating for many, many reasons, but one of them is because he is an unreliable narrator to his own life. He's put out some of his own, and again, these were privately printed autobiographies, like books. Throughout the years, the way that he changes his story to fit whatever the audience, he would hop on trends, you know, so he would affiliate himself with the one percenter motorcycle gangs, and then he would tell his story through this Mormon lens, and then he would try to be like a Branson family style entertainer, and just he has certain beats of his story that he always tells, but he always, I don't know, there's a self-aggrandizing element of it, and I think that the whole career is fascinating because he did have talent, but he was a loudmouth and a self-saboteur. Just a lot of the bad career moves, he has nobody to blame but himself. It seems to be a prominent sort of belief now that you have to sign off on the things that artists do or that people do that you find fascinating. And I think that's absolutely insane. I think you can think that the Jonestown cult is fascinating. That doesn't mean I think Jim Jones is a good person, but yeah, you can be fascinated by things that you don't personally agree with.
And that cult really was trying to change. They went the wrong way. They made a really bad fucking left turn at some point, but they were trying to end the way we see race in a positive way for a decade.
Yeah, it seemed to have very honorable intentions.
I'm excited for you to listen to the episode I did with Jody, because it's all about those kind of groups. It's all about like all that shit. She also did a huge project on Unarius. You know Unarius?
Oh yeah, I've got their, I still get mail from Unarius because I ordered a bunch of Blu-rays from them.
Did you order The Arrival?
Uh-huh. I got that one, and oh God, there were a couple other ones, but The Arrival is the...
I watched that for research, and I watched it twice. I still don't know. I don't love that. I don't love the guy. I just think he's dumb.
Yeah. But at the same time, Rich, that sort of goes back to the thing we were talking about earlier, is I would rather experience something that was created by somebody who absolutely means it.
Right. And I'm in the same boat as you, which is why I'm enjoying this conversation, because I mean, again, private press is my favorite because it's real. Are there any, you know, folks you really got into that just like making that record was just a fucking monumental thing that they got through, or any story you have? I'm just guiding you if you can find something. I'm trying to give you.
So a thing about sort of how I listen to music, and this isn't hard and fast, but often I'll find myself listening to a particular artist, going down that rabbit hole and listening to everything I can. And I've recently been going back to The Residents. I'm not sure how familiar you are with The Residents.
Tell me about it, because I don't know. I know very little. I know that I need to watch a documentary, and that's about it.
Yeah. So they've been going around for about 50 years. They started out as this art collective. Originally, the main group of them were from Louisiana, and they ended up going out to San Francisco in the late 60s, you know, like Summer of Love, that era. And they formed this little arts collective, and making music was just part of it, because they were working on film, they were doing poster art, they were doing like performance art, like crashing open mic nights and doing all this stuff. But the thing about them was that they weren't necessarily musicians, but they played a lot of tapes and sounds and sort of created music without the musical, I don't want to say without the musical skill, but basically they were about creating music out of chaos.
Does that kind of fall into like the Ramones and punk? Is it kind of like you use certain tools and you just do your own thing with it? Does that fall in that category for you, or not so much?
I think it's even something different than that, because they weren't they weren't so much playing music and writing songs as they were taking, they would record these jams and stuff like this, and then they would take the tape, and it was almost like a music concrete, where it's just taking all this sound and then shaping it into something.
All right, so Resident, is there another one or two, I don't know, give me something odd, give me something out there, if you have something, anything special to your heart, even if it's a certain album that brings up certain memories or certain attachments.
Yeah, I'll say that I have a deep love of gospel, particularly black gospel music from 50s, 60s, 70s, that era. And a lot of it goes back to, again, even if they're not the most polished and even if they're not the most professional, there is a sincerity and an authenticity and a naturalness that when four or five people have been singing together forever, they can just fall into it. I think that the Swanee Quintet from Augusta, Georgia, just exemplary for that reason. I mean, they can just fall into it, and it doesn't sound precise, but it sounds so right.
Let's use what we're talking about now, and I want you to bring it into maybe some posts. I want people to get an idea of like what they would, if they go to your page, what they could see and hear. And I'm wondering if we're talking about gospel, if there's, you know, I don't know, any recent posts or things that really fit in that world for you.
As far as what the page is, basically, and I haven't been as frequent updating it as I have been in the past, but basically when I have time to sit and really listen to a record and really pay attention and focus in on it and stuff like that, you know, it's just a picture of what I'm listening to and some paragraphs about how I'm engaging with it, whether that is the history. Nice. Record, or whether it's how I can relate to it on a much more personal level, or if I have any sort of sentimentality and stuff to it. Talking about gospel every Sunday morning, and I still do this, but I used to post it. I would just listen to gospel records all morning and sort of post and sort of what my impressions were from it and any sort of interesting context that I knew. So yeah, it's a dialogue.
In terms of like gospel music, when was one of your first memories of really understanding gospel? And I was wondering if it had to do with the church of any kind or not so much the church. Is the church involved with your connection to gospel?
Oh, man. So I grew up in a very fundamentalist Southern Baptist household. And a lot of the gospel music that I was exposed to was really soulless. It was there was no joy in it. I heard a lot of bluegrass gospel that resonated with me, and I ended up playing bluegrass in my high school years. But in terms of getting into the black gospel, that almost coincided with me discovering that I don't believe, because it's one of those things. These songs, they're prayers. They're all prayers. Yeah. There's a sincerity and an openness to it in a world that is out there actively trying to grind you down, and you're finding joy and peace and solace, and you're expressing something that is bigger than yourself to something that is bigger than yourself. It was so heartfelt. As I was losing my own faith, I was developing a very strong connect to gospel music, which sounds backwards.
That makes a lot of sense, but go on.
I'll send this to you. Actually, around that time, when I was really started digging into all this, I recorded a gospel record of my own. And,
oh, shit. I think I might have bought that through your thing, but send it to me if you can. I think at some point I bought the stuff you had on
Bandcamp. I'll send you a link or whatever. But yeah, so I just when I would go back and, you know, visit my parents and go to church with them and stuff, just the music was so reserved and so passionless. I don't know, it didn't sit right with me, because if you're supposed to have this direct connection to your creator, then why can't you express joy?
Do you feel like the music you like that self fits in gospel are like either critical or people's like personal prayer, and there's a godliness in that, but it's for them, not for God?
I think that there is an element of ego that probably figures into it, because you have to also remember that, like, a lot, especially like with some of these black ones, you know, they were show bands too. They were going to the Apollo and they were going to all these big venues, and there is an element of showmanship that you have to have. I think that maybe you can sniff out the sincere from the insincere.
Do you feel like the songs for those people are still an act of worship, even if it's to a God that they don't believe in? Are they, do you see that as acts of faith or acts of prayer in their music, even though it's disconnected from belief?
I think that there's some degree in that. I can only relate it back to my own connection with gospel music, in the fact that I might not have the belief, but there is a greater truth that is being conveyed in some way or another. And that is about redemption and about working through the struggle, whether it's an internal struggle or an external struggle. You can say prayer, but you can just as easily say meditation or self-reflection. It's a very engaged, and it's engaged with something that's operating at a higher plane. And so I think that there are probably people out there who aren't very sincere with it. In order to do that with any feeling, I think that you're having to connect with something.
That makes perfect sense to me. I don't know if you know about what's his, the artist? Outsider Artist did the cover for Talking Heads.
Oh, Reverend Howard Finster. Yeah.
I feel like he fits into the world, maybe not exactly musically. I know he has some recordings, but it seems like he, you know, in this last conversation I had with Jody, we just got into all this stuff, and it just seems like there's a purity in being on the outside, and there's an intelligence when you don't have to worry about conforming. And I wonder if my bigger question is, do you feel like these people's goal in a certain way is freeing themselves by this music?
I think so. And I also think that when you're creating, again, without that expectation of some sort of, you know, brass ring to be grabbed. And again, somebody like Howard Finster, he didn't pick up doing art till he was quite old, and he wasn't trained in any particular way. But I think that he felt something inside himself that he had to communicate. And I think that sort of serving that need to communicate whatever truth that you have found in yourself, or you have found in some power, or you have found in whatever, I think that there is a beauty in that, because it is done for higher reasons.
Let me just ask you one more question for maybe 2-3 minutes. I'm just curious on the process of taking that all in and then doing your own work to share your own truth in your own album. What was that like? If you can form that, you know, take 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, whatever you need. I'm just curious on that process.
I think that in the music that I created, I think that my intention was, even if I don't believe in God in any conventional sense, I believe in gospel music.
Yeah.
And I believe that there is a way to communicate that is very sincere. Maybe me singing gospel music is like somebody telling a parable, where it's not the literal interpretation of the story that you need to be concerned about. It's the greater truth, the greater something that is being created. And certainly in my own recording, there's a lot of, you know, and I had some hangups about it. I ended up not really finishing it because there were songs about hell and all this stuff. And that was part of my own hangups, because again, from the time I was a child, hell was the thing that was being drilled in my brain. Even after pretty sure I didn't believe anymore, there were years and years and years where I was still frightened to death of dying and going to hell.
It's also a lot. It's a lot of shit to put on a fucking child. And it's a lot about control. And it's a lot of control to put on a fucking child. I'm the same. So, I mean, I believed in God up until I was 11. Then I heard about the Holocaust. So I'm like, no. And it seems like you had the same awakening in other ways. Like, once you really dig into it, it doesn't make any sense.
Certainly with religion and churches and stuff like that, I think that intent has a lot to do with it. If your intent is fear and dominate and control and subversion, that's not very good. And that's the world that I grew up in. Now, I think that when you're there for things like community and fellowship and support, it's the difference between a tool and a weapon. You know what I mean? If it's something that helps you sense of the world, if it helps you understand the world, if it helps you to better understand yourself and how you need to interact within this world, and if it is a tool, then use the tool. You know, but if it's becoming a weapon, don't put your head on that chopping block.
I don't use the word cult because apparently they go by like new religious movements. Are there any, you know, any religious movements that you've gravitated towards, even if you don't necessarily join or believe, that speak to you?
You know, I engage with a lot of that kind of thing through the art that they put out. Certainly the Source family and the Yahuwah 13 records, I think they're incredible. They're so just, I don't know, there's something else. I enjoyed the Unarians. They felt so compelled to put these films out. I think that those kinds of things are how I best interact with it. I don't necessarily go out looking for it. I certainly don't go looking for it as a personal remedy to anything. But I think that when they put out these sort of pieces of art in whatever form they are, I think it's always very interesting to engage with, because you're getting a window into how these people live. There is a guy who in the late 60s, his name is Dave Bixby.
I know there's a drug song. The drug song?
Yeah, that was him. But he the record is called, and I'm going to butcher this, it's Ode to Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah. I know that album.
Yeah, and I think that And again, if you read further into his story, you can understand how that record was the result of him starting to get pulled into a cult, but it was coinciding with him finding this spiritual regeneration and kicking drugs and seeing what he assumed to be the light. And so it's a very spiritual work. It's spiritual autobiography is not a new thing. That's all, you know, the Book of Marjorie Kemp and all this, you know, there's been people doing this sort of spiritual autobiography for a long time. And I think that Dave Bixby's record is amazing.
Well, it's great talk. I'm going to let you go. It's great talking to you. Can you plug your page again real quick? I just want that to be in there in case people like missed a part of this or something.
On Instagram, it's An Earful of Wax. There's a period between each word. So an.earful.of.wax.
We have Franken here. Franken, tell us about your. This is a focus on some of the people that follow us that I really like their accounts. So we're trying to do focuses on those folks that give them a little bump, hopefully, and spread the word about what they're doing. So you're our first one. Hey,
hello. I hear
you. How's it going, Franken? Right?
Yeah. What's up?
No, thanks again for reaching out. I really appreciate.
What exactly is the Vintage Annals Archive? Is it physical? Do you have physical media, or is it mostly online?
Okay, so let me skip it. So I do consider the Instagram an archive because there's literally 15,000 fucking images on there. 16.2. Yeah. That's a piece of it. There's more to it. I mean, I have a photo archive. So there's about like 10 or 15 or 20 like found and family photo archives here. So that's a piece of like the archive. And I do have a physical archive, mostly fit photos, and I do 3D photography, and I have a nice 3D collection of all kinds of like old projectors and cameras and old like found photos, family photos. And then one thing I think you might dig is educational content. We do these things called deep dives, which are really like structures that we have about maybe 30 or 35. This is like if you you know your idea about doing more like one or two, like to me this would be a better way to do it because you know do a deep dive and that's the post.
Yeah.
Because when you go and this is one on like you know private press records.
Yes. Yeah. I'm so actually like, on that page right now. I was looking at that.
So if you go into private press, again, it's meant for like you to do a deep dive, but it has a mix, YouTube playlists, books. It kind of gives you all this shit to look on your own. But there's like there's one on Daniel Johnston. There's, you know, Hunter Thompson, Klaus Nomi. There's just all, you know.
Leave them wanting more, you know. I sort through, you know, a few hundred records a week, but I try to only post one or two tops a day just because like, you know, people don't want to like look at a bunch of. I mean, my job is to look at all the 45s and find the cool ones. And post
I hear
them.
You. I hear
and
you.
And your job is to look through all this cool stuff and post it. And I think that, especially right now, what you're doing is not only interesting but important as far as like sharing the history of like a lot of marginalized groups and stuff. So
yeah,
there's a real connection there people can have with your stuff. It's purely just like. You know, it's just a matter of there's so much of it.
No. I appreciate that.
The content is not the problem. It's just the amount of it and like the curation of it. Like, it sucks that it's this way, but we have to be gatekeepers in a way to content.
Yeah. I highly appreciate your
advice. Not everyone wants to look through everything like we do. And so.
All right. Let me talk to you about your shit because I feel pretty good. I've been trying to do these what I'm calling like. I don't know. I don't even know the name of them yet, but there's right now it's you and my friend Joe. It's talking about
cool.
Just like people that follow me that I just notice that are doing cool shit. How's your podcast? What have you built in your podcast?
Yeah, I've been doing it for over 6 years now. Great. Awesome. Cool. I do Dollar Country, which is my Instagram account and my radio show / podcast. It's a radio show, but it's available as a podcast, which means you can download it whenever you want or listen to it whenever you want. And it is on a bunch of radio stations, but it's kind of straddles that world of between radio show and podcast.
And your focus is more on like, is more on country or more old school country? Tell me
what
your focus on.
I collect old country 45s and just gradually has built it into this. Like every week I play between 15 and 20 records that I find stuff primarily that's completely unheard of or lesser known almost always stuff that hasn't been digitized before in any way.
Oh, wow. Holy shit.
Yeah. So all the stuff, almost all the stuff I play is not available anywhere else.
How do you learn about those things? How do you find those records?
At this point, I have a lot of relationships with record dealers and stuff, but I travel around the country and dig for records pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
What are some, I don't know if you can think recently, I hate asking like top five, but what are some, I don't know, what are some recent or what are some holy grail items you have either found or looking to, or you know, are the ones you're always looking for? And if you're going to answer that question, I'm curious on your, I feel like when people collect things, there's a certain attachment. Maybe it's the album your father played for you, or, you know, maybe it's some producer. You're like, I don't know if there's a way to attach a value in your end of it, what that value would be, like more like the meaning of it to you. If that falls into that, it's a big question, but.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, some of the most important stuff to me is stuff that I feel in some very small way responsible for having shared to a wider audience. So, I mean, which is a lot of what I play, but there's this guy, Buddy Pruitt, he's passed away now, but he was from Fort Smith, Arkansas. And I found one of his records and quickly tried to get everything I could find from him and have shared that. And a lot of people really like his music. So I feel like that was really important to me to be able to share stuff that I really like to people who also like it.
Yeah.
There's another guy named Wayne Cadell who was, I believe is still living, although I have not been able to contact him, who is from the Omaha Council Bluffs area, Omaha, Nebraska, Council Bluffs, Iowa. And he did some songs in the 70s about drinking beer and smoking weed and playing country music, which I really like.
Yeah.
He's another guy that
you like those three activities, or you like the song?
Yeah, I like the song. I especially like country songs about smoking weed because, like, country guys were all smoking weed and doing pills, but like there was this taboo about talking about it because of like weird like hippie cowboy culture stuff.
Does Jeff Cowell fit into the stuff you collect?
That's a great question. I'm not sure.
Do you know who Jeff Cowell is?
Cowell?
See, because there's a song he sings. It's called like something. Like, it reminds me you're talking about. It's Lucky Jeff Cowell. There's a song. Yeah, that Lucky Strikes like in Liquid Gold.
That sounds like something I'd like if I found it. Although his stuff looks like it's a little bit outside of my price range.
It's a little. Well, it's just you might enjoy it as listening. But go on. I'm sorry. But we talked before about like private press. It seems like in a way, just by hearing you talk, that it does fit more into what would be country private press, especially considering it doesn't exist.
That's basically
not widely known.
I generally call it regional or small label. But yeah, a lot of private press too. But it's basically the same thing. So for instance, the difference between this Jeff Cowell and what I would normally do is I am a cheapskate. So I'm looking to find the cool stuff that hasn't been found yet.
I hear you. That's interesting.
Whereas I am not, I'm willing to spend 6 hours flipping through shitty records to find cool records. Whereas I'm not necessarily willing to spend $300 or $400 on this one Jeff Cowell record.
I hear you.
If it's desirable, it kind of, you know, I can spend $400 or $500 on like 1,045s.
No. I'm in the same boat with
collecting. So that's kind of my thing, is like, I like to find all the stuff because really I think there's also like this collector's culture puts a spotlight on certain things and says, you know, we look at certain like quote unquote famous record collectors and like, oh, this guy said this psych record is like the best one. And it's like, yeah, that's cool. But like, also there was like a million psych bands from everywhere. Yeah. And like, just because this one is really good, doesn't mean that like the three local kids from your neighborhood you didn't even know about weren't just as important. Like, as far as like actual importance, you know, like looking back, like there's this weird importance people sometimes put on. There's this thing that people say about racist records where it's like, oh, it's a piece of history. And it's like, how is a racist record any more a piece of history than literally any other 45?
Yeah.
Like that's like saying any of the records I have, they're just as much a piece of history of as anything else. And I feel like that gets lost because people think, oh, it has to be this certain thing, or it has to be like the best of the best. But to me, it's like, these were all people sharing their stories and living lives. And that's like what's so important to me. It's like, it's like living history, you know?
Yeah. And I think what I like about just talking to you, I think that's like, you know, that's what you and I have in common in terms of what the kind of stuff we post, which I always love finding people. What I'm curious about is, in terms of all your research, what is the like oddest variant of country music you found? I feel like there, you know, like you look, there's like, I'm a big fan of gospel, so you'll find gospel funk, gospel soul. Have you found
like
music that you wanted to be listenable, that you enjoy, that it's just this odd mix that you never, what are some good things that you would, look at and be like, this country sitar album looks horrible. Like, what are some odd mixtures of things that you've found whether they're good or bad? I'm just curious on like some of the oddities.
I personally try to collect drum machine country, which is like any
country.
What is
that? It's a real thing?
I mean, it's just, that's what I call it. It's any country that uses a drum machine, which is just like kind of a weird connection of worlds, because the tradition of country music is that you have house bands and like studio bands. So you always kind of had instruments if you needed them.
Yeah.
So the sort of person that would need a drum machine is probably the sort of person who is also making their own music at home. And it's not always good, but it's just interesting because it's like you don't hear a lot of drum machine in country. But yeah, there's also, you know, country funk and country soul that is a little more popular now. But yeah.
Have you like done a lot of research into studios in terms of like, you know, house, like, you know, studio musicians that they've used? Have you done any like local research into some exciting, like, I don't know, some like some of the more outsider, you know, labels or studios that really produce some great shit? Are there any labels in particular that are more down home, small town or regional that are interesting to you?
I mean, yeah, there's a million of them, honestly. There's
two or three that you really feel like.
Well, one of the more famous ones is Rim Rock out of Concord, Arkansas. That was a pretty amazing label, honestly. A lot of their stuff is just good.
Okay.
There's all sorts of stuff. Up where you're kind of near where I'm, more than in the Dayton area, there's a label called Jalyn, J-L-Y-N, which I believe is named after Jack Lynch, who was the owner.
Huh.
That did mostly, a lot of bluegrass, mostly bluegrass and country. You find a lot of that stuff. But once, the more that I learn about record collecting, the more it's like, oh shit, there's like 15 of these like kind of interesting small labels in every state. You know, they're like everywhere.
It's
just a matter of learning them.
Are there certain archives where you get information about this kind of stuff, or just pages, or how do you find out information about this kind of stuff?
I use newspapers.com and newspapersarchives.com. Newspapers.com, which I think is like weird. It's like owned by Ancestry, which I think means it's owned by like the Mormon Church or something. So like fishy, but they have a ton of old newspapers. So a lot of these people, there's no, if you Google a lot of people that I play, there's not going to be any information or much information. So
yeah.
I'll search for old newspaper articles and find some information, or I use Discogs a lot. And then there's like a handful of other record collectors kind of like me who have websites where they put in research and stuff like that.
Is it a supportive community you're finding in terms of like other folks out there doing the same kind of shit, or is it a little more, I don't know?
Yes and no. I find that a lot of country collectors are pretty supportive of each other. We're like all friends, but I mean, also at the same time, like we all, you know, we all want the records too. So like, there's definitely an aspect especially with old records. It's like,
I like how you put that. We're friends until I have to fight you to be the first in line at this very particular sale.
Right. It's like, you know, some of these records were fine. Like there are records that I found that it's like, I don't know how many copies of this exist. It could only be like five. Who fucking knows? And so like, I want to have it because I'm trying to digitize and share all this stuff. So to me, like, it's like important to be able to have it instead of just being in a collector's basement. But at the same time, like, I mean, who am I to say that I should get it over someone else, you know?
Well, but I just gave away a photo collection I had because I felt like someone else could use it better than I could. And I feel like it seems like you're at least sharing. You're not just hoarding and like, I own it. You know, here's it on my thing and no one can look at it. Like, what I wanted to ask is, tell me about your history in country music in general. Like, how did, you know, what turned you on to country music overall? Was it something you learned as a kid?
No, not really. I actually am not I didn't grow up listening to country music. I mean, my dad liked Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and stuff. Okay. My heater's about to kick on. That's going to be that.
Oh, no worries. No worries.
So I remember in high school, my dad, like in the early days of like file sharing and stuff and CD burning, my dad like gave me a list of Johnny Cash songs. He was like, hey, make me a CDR of this or whatever.
Okay.
And so I did. And I was like, oh, this is actually like pretty fucking awesome. And that was kind of one of my first intros outside of like Doc Watson and some bluegrass guys. And so that kind of stewed in me for a while. And I didn't really like, I was always more into bluegrass than any sort of straight country. But then when I started getting more into record collecting, I realized that there's just, the dollar bins were full of country stuff because nobody gave a shit about it. And it's like a take it for granted genre because everyone knows it. It's been around for 100 years and it is famous and it is popular still, but people also, you know, they don't think they need to buy a Hank Williams 45, or they didn't like 5 or 6 years ago. They do now.
Do you feel like country in a certain sense fits into the idea of folk music? When I say folk music, I don't mean like, you know, Joni Mitchell. I mean like music of the people. Do you feel like it is more, you know, at least the stuff you collect, because I feel like it's more of like, this is music of real everyday American people who are just putting their music out because they want to.
Yeah. Yes. I think that for a lot of people that I play, they weren't choosing to play country music. They were just playing music, and that was the sort of music that was in their lives. You know what I mean?
What is the format of your show? Is it mostly just playing? Are you talking about these people? Are you presenting histories on these people? And I'm also curious on like, is your archival, if you're archiving these, is it mostly through the podcast app, or are you archiving this stuff in some sense?
So the show is, I do 3 sets. I usually play between 15 and 18 songs.
Give us a name so people can, if they miss it in the beginning, they can hear the name of what you're doing.
Oh, Dollar Country. Yeah, dollarcountry.org if you want to check it out. I play 3 sets of tunes and usually 15 to 18 songs, depending on how much I run over or how long they are. And then in between, before every episode, I do hours of research trying to figure out, you know, when they released, who the artists were, where the artists were from, where the labels were from, that sort of stuff. I try to give a little bit of information about each one if I can, and depending on the amount of time I have to prepare, you know, more and more information.
What makes you do that? Why are these important things to share for you?
Well, people seem to like it and I find it interesting. So it's just like, you know, I may as well share it.
That was a bit of a push question.
But in the beginning of the show, I mean, I didn't know much about country music. So if you listen from the beginning of the show till now, you're kind of hearing me learn about country music. I gradually got more interested in like smaller and smaller, you know, labels and stuff. And I just got to the point where I was like, it would be beneficial to me and to people if I made sure to spend a few hours researching before every show.
When you do the research, does it, and you kind of look back, play back the music, does it change your perspective on the music once you know more about the person? And if so, what ways does that happen?
Yeah, it can for sure. I mean, sometimes, well, in a very, yes, in a very cut and dry way, if I learned that the person was a bad person or racist or something, I almost always choose not to play them.
Okay.
But as far as like just learning about someone's life, like, it doesn't, if the song's good, the song's good. And if the song's bad, the song's bad. But if I I forget the name of the guy, but I looked up a dude for an episode, you know, a year ago or whatever. And I found out that he was a sign painter, like a billboard painter. Like he would actually like hand paint whole billboards back in the 50s or 60s.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought that was like, that's like badass, because first of all, people don't fucking do that anymore. There's one guy in Cleveland who does that where I'm from, and it's like a specialty. But like this dude did it as a living because people, you know, Jack Daniels, when they came to wherever he was in Tennessee, needed a billboard. So they hired him to paint it. And I was like, that's just badass. Like, it gives you a look into what life was like back then, because in a lot of ways it's so different now that we often forget. And for people that are, you know, younger than us, like I remember my grandparents or my parents telling stories about the old days, but you know, as people get younger and younger and we get older and older, like those sort of stories get lost through oral history, so you kind of have to look them up through newspapers and stuff.
And I think, you know, it seems what the importance of what you're doing is, I don't know, you know, it's the idea that there's a history, I mean, there's stories there's a history, there's lessons in that music. And if, you know, the idea that if we don't know our history, we're doomed to repeat it. I think what you're doing is very valuable because it's teaching what happened before, and then it gives us an idea of where to go. And then, you know, I mean, I feel like country music, in my understanding, I'm not a huge, I don't know a ton of country. I love country, but more like old school, old 70s. But it's, you know, there's a lot about just American life and living, just like down, you know, people's stories. When you were just talking about before, the guy you just mentioned, that made me think of Howard Finster. Have you ever dug into his stuff?
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Howard Finster was an outsider artist, but he made some of these, like, these odd gospel recordings. But he did, like, he did a few famous albums. He did Little Creatures, Talking Heads, one of the R.E.M. albums. He's very, I don't know if you probably can't see my phone. Anyway, he would dig him because he was, you know, kind of had that life. I also just want to quickly ask you about Lee Hazlewood. What's your relationship, if any, with Lee Hazlewood?
Well, I like his stuff. I have some stuff. He ran a label and did recording down in Phoenix, I think, Arizona.
Oh, wow. What was his label?
That's a great question. Let me look.
Was it just for his music or was it other people's music?
It was for other people. I believe it was it Liberty Bell?
Okay.
Or Viv?
It's okay. I mean, I can, I'm not worried about
Yeah, Viv,
right now.
Viv Records Incorporated is Viv based Records. Out of Phoenix. But it was started by Lee Hazlewood and sold to Lloyd Klingman, who is another artist on there that I like.
Oh, nice. I think about him because I consider him like an outsider Johnny Cash to a certain extent.
Yeah, he's definitely an interesting fella for sure. He did a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. And also, you know, I mean, one of my favorite albums is 13. Talking before about like mixing different, you know, styles together. It's like a country lounge album, really.
Yeah, he did a lot of cool stuff with like including country music into more popular art forms in a way that wasn't hokey. Because some people tried to do it and it sucked. So he did it in a way that I really enjoy.
I want to ask you, in terms of the histories you've done, if there's maybe one or two people or three that you might want to share a minute story each or two about these people that you found. Are there any people that particularly spoke to you and who they were? Or you just, you know, you were kind of curious that, you know, they had interesting stories or lives?
That's a great question. So the guy I mentioned earlier, Buddy Pruitt, who was from Fort Smith, Arkansas. I have tried to find out information about him and tried to contact his family, although I haven't quite been successful yet. But he owned an oil company that is still in Fort Smith that I believe makes parts for oil rigs or something. I don't believe they actually dig for oil. I think it's part of the industry. But that's still there. And if you go back through his catalog, like his first couple records were on smaller labels that were labels used to do this kind of like pay to play sort of thing where you would basically pay an established label to release your recording. And it's like they're called custom presses. And so he did that on one label on K-Arc. And then he did some other stuff before he started self-releasing his own records. And then most of his stuff is on his self-release label, which is Derek Records.
Okay.
And so like, I've just kind of put together the story of being like, okay, at one point this guy obviously like wanted to make a go at it with country music. And then it seems to be that later on, this is totally just my hypothesis.
No.
Later on, he almost all of his songs are about oil or digging for oil and stuff like that. Or and like rodeos and stuff. So obviously he worked in that field. So I think after maybe he lived the country music dream for a couple of years, and when it didn't pan out, he started doing the other stuff and using and just self-releasing his own music.
Well, imagine there's songs called like I Like Money. And, yeah. You know, like it's great. It's great not being broke.
Yeah, totally. Any other? It's really cool.
Any other people in that category that you found fascinating?
I mean, he's the one that comes to mind because he's the one I've spent the most time with, like his music and stuff.
I'm going to ask you one more question, then we'll call it a day. I'm also just curious, in general. I mean, it's hard to know a musical past in terms of interest because mine changed so much, but what would you What are some other music that really has influenced you or is really taking a lot of space up in your life now or historically? What are the kind of genres or like artists that are, you know, in your ballpark that you really?
Yeah. Well, Ween is my favorite band of all time.
Why is that? So, what about Ween? Is it that?
I don't know. I just connected with them when I was in middle school and it never stopped. Gotcha. It's like, you know, when you like a band, when you're that age, you kind of grew up with them and
yeah.
You associate different songs with the different moods you're going through and stuff. So it's kind of the point where I can't like separate myself from them.
Any songs that particularly bring up a story or a memory?
I remember the whole album of The Pod. I remember specifically listening to that when I was sick at home from school, sick, and I had rented the first Tony Hawk Pro Skater for PlayStation.
Nice.
And I associate that album with still like being sick.
Why do you think music kind of goes along with probably the most vivid memories we have of things?
Because music is something you can do while you're doing other stuff. Like you can, for me, I mean, music is like one of the most important things in my life for like has been forever, you know? And, but like when I think about music as a media, how it's unique is like, for instance, I remember seeing like really amazing parts of movies or playing really amazing parts of video games for the first time. But those are amazing because they were all encompassing. Like I was in a theater watching The Matrix for the first time, which blew my fucking mind. You know?
My God.
Or like, I remember there's a part in Fallout 4 where you go into like this totally bombed out area and playing that for the first time, I was like, oh man, this is like so cool. But like with music, the thing that's amazing about it is you can sit down and just listen to it. And that is very valuable. And you do get a lot out of that. But music for, I think a lot of people is a soundtrack to doing other stuff. So still when I listen to certain records, I think about when I was going to university and like walking up the hill to university, I used to listen to this record all the time. And if I listen to that record now, I will think about that time because music was a pairing with those acts as opposed to just being an all encompassing piece of media.
It also seems to transcend memory in a way. Like I know I had an aunt, who, you know, she had dementia from like, I don't know, 70 on, but she could play, she played accordion. She knew music. Her memory was never affected by with music. She could play everything. What do you think it is about that? The place where it just is almost part of your soul that you can still do it even if you don't know who you are.
I mean, that's
the big question.
That's fucking crazy.
You have to be like Oliver Sacks. You have to be Oliver Sacks to answer that question. But I'm curious on what your opinion is on why do you think like the brain works in whatever way it works in that it can fucking memorize music when you don't even know who you are or who your kids are or where you're at.
I mean, yeah, that's a great question. I'm sure there are interesting answers to that. As far as my own personal connection to that is, I used to do marching band.
Cool.
And I was in the drum line. And I remember there was a lot of stuff. You have to memorize everything. And I remember like after a while, after you play something hundreds of times, it really does just become like you don't even, you can like play through a whole piece and not even notice sometimes. It it's just like, it's like so in your head and in your hands. I was in drumline, so. You know, like sometimes it's just in your hands and you can just let your hands go and it'll just do it. And I can still go back and play like practice stuff from back then or like warm ups and be like, oh yeah, this is like still pretty easy for me. So I think it connects to like definitely a deep part of your brain, especially if you've memorized a piece.
It takes a long time
and you have to, it's not just in your memory banks. It's like, you know, it's deep in there.
What year are you talking? What year were you in marching band?
I graduated high school in 2002, so I did marching band at the end of high school and then at the beginning of college, so around.
So I'm curious if I want to vision you doing this. What are some of the songs you would have done back in the day?
Jeez.
And I'm hoping they're more heavy metal version. I'm hoping they're like metal and like rap.
No. In high school, it was mostly classic rock. We did like some Simon and Garfunkel. And,
nice.
I remember one for sophomore year in high school. It was like all movie themes, so it was like Indiana Jones. And then the senior year was kind of like jazzy stuff, so we did like some like Birdland, Weather Report, stuff like that. In college, it became a lot less like playing the hits. It was more like intense.
You were also in band in college?
Yeah, that was where I was in like the university drumline, which is like a whole nother beast. But I don't remember what we played in college, honestly. Probably too busy drinking.
And do you, you play music, but do you also play like guitar or are you in a band? Do you play music actively now?
No, my like creative output is kind of just done by the show now, but yeah I played drums since I was like 12. I was in a stoner rock band for a long time, which is how I ended up moving to Cleveland.
I need more specifics on that. When you say stoner rock band, give me some.
I was in a band called Davidson. Okay. No, it was like stoner metal. It's more like Sleep.
Stoner metal. Okay.
Yeah. And so like Sleep or Motorhead.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so, yeah, that's how I met my wife, you know, like being in that band and touring around and meeting her in Cleveland. Cause that's I lived in Kansas. Yeah. So
how long have you all been together?
I think probably like 5 years.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
I've done the show for slightly more. So yeah, about 5 years, but I mean, yeah, like without a doubt, like music isn't just important in my life. It actually has like shaped my life.
So one thing I feel like in terms of the page, our page, one reason I look into the stuff, into the more obscure stuff is because I'm bored by the same old shit, but I feel like it's like, I feel like a lot of you, I mean, I don't know what your opinion is, but my opinion of newer music is it's like, you know, at a certain point, there's only certain variations left of music and a lot of it's been done. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of it's been done better. I mean, something I would say for years is if you get almost any record between 66 and like 78, it's going to be probably good, especially if it's in the rock. I feel like that time frame in my estimation, especially with soul and funk, anything in that time frame is pretty good. Not everything, because it was before everything got really commercial and bigger.
Yeah. There are certain time periods where the exploration and experimentation in music led to really amazing stuff that it won't ever be quite like that again.
I guess the question I have is, are you also recycling this because it's better than half the stuff that exists now? Or maybe not so much. I don't know.
Not necessarily that. Although I do kind of wish someone would do like a version of my show, but with like all just like self-released Bandcamp stuff. Cause there's like millions of awesome stuff on Bandcamp that, you know what I mean? Like it just happens to be that I'm dealing with old media, but I naturally gravitate towards music that is lower fidelity and that was not recorded as well. So
I gotcha.
My sweet spot is kind of like 40s through 60s, just nice. Like sound wise personally.
I'm curious if you can just give me like three recent records that you're enjoying, that something you might play on your show.
Sure. So there's a dude I played with last night, actually, named Willie Carlisle, who is a really amazing folk country musician who is a storyteller and also tells a story in the history of instruments and songs and protest songs and stuff. Cool. I think you might really connect with this stuff. He has a recent record called Peculiar Missouri you might like. But Willie Carlisle, he's great. And then my other, also who's a friend of mine, who I'm like very happy to call my friend, is Nick Shoulders. He released a couple records. These are all guys who are making country music who I think are saying the things that I wish was being said in country music, like
I hear you.
Inclusivity and you know, social structures and like helping each other and like trying to take country music away from this baggage that it has of being a conservative Christian art form.
And it seems so like it adds a lot of heavy.
So I really like that. So yeah, Willie Carlisle, Nick Shoulders, Sierra Farrell is another big one. She's like super big. She's like kind of blowing up right now,
nice.
Which is totally good for her. I'm so happy to see people who are making this sort of like modern country music that isn't pop country that I really like. So yeah, if you're gonna check out three people, I'd say Willie Carlisle, Nick Shoulders, and Sierra Farrell.
One last question: have you ever thought about going the route of a label and trying to put this stuff out in vinyl so other folks could enjoy it? Or is that just too expensive of a process, or is that just not in your interest level?
I would love to. There's a lot of legal problems because I would personally want to be able to contact these people to get their permission.
Right.
And sometimes it's just not possible. I would go the bootleg route if that were the only hurdle, but the other hurdle is that there are very real corporations who sometimes own this music, even if they don't give a shit about it and don't even want it to be out there.
They
can fuck with you if they would like to.
I remember the company that owned Birthday, Happy Birthday, apparently didn't own Happy Birthday, but still charged people 30 fucking
years.
Yeah,
what a bunch of assholes. But yeah, I'd love to. I mean, short, like the short answer is I would love to be able to do that. Yeah. And I release mixtapes with stuff, but yeah, I'd love to like release some.
Something with like you know, I'm a big fan of reissues and something about hearing that stuff on vinyl, even though it's not an exact experience, it's a nice thing. But thank you so much for chatting, man.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Again, thanks for checking out. Again, this is our kind of bonus series on just different accounts that we like. If you feel like your account is in the same world as we are, please send me a message or connect with me, and I'd love to chat as long as it fits into all we're doing. But again, we're really trying to expose others to some really great Instagram accounts that could use a, you know, a little boost of you know really great caliber stuff. So again, check out these two. And if you are interested in you can join at, you can find me and direct message me at Vintage Archive, our Instagram, or our email, vintageanalsarchive@gmail.com to Rich. And I'd love to look into your stuff and make sure it fits and have, you know, have a chat. We got two more that are going to be part of these coming up soon, Long Lost Personals and Awful Books.
We thought in different ways.